Batu, Baradun, Nikto.
You must remember those words.
Gordon's alive.
You know what the Turing test is?
I know Kung Fu.
Dead or alive, you are coming with me.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Stories Out of Time and Space. I'm your regular host, Scott Weatherly, and as always, I'm joined by Julian Darius. Julian, how are you doing? You okay?
I am thoroughly traumatized.
That's right.
How about you?
Similar. I was kind of surprised. We are going to be talking about The Day After, a TV movie from 1983, which traumatized an awful lot of people, including, if legend be believed, Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
The story of a small Midwestern, is it Colorado? Midwestern?
Kansas.
Yeah, small, Kansas town. Kansas town outside of a nuclear missile silo base, and the lead up and the aftermath of a nuclear attack on America, and how it sort of affects people. Quite a heady cast. Jason Roberts, Joe Beth Williams, Steve Guttenberg in an early role, John Cullum, John Lithgow, Bibi Besh. And some real. I was watching this and going, oh my God, there's some names cropping up, some people I recognize. So this was a TV film. It runs for about 2.5 hours, or just over 2 hours, I should say, sorry.
Well, you haven't mentioned it was directed by Nicholas Meyer,
yes,
of Star Trek II fame.
Yes, that's a good point.
So,
yeah,
quite a pedigree.
He basically sort of like, he was like, "This, I've done the Wrath of Khan. I'm now going to do the Wrath of Yeltsin."
The Wrath of Gorbachev.
Gorbachev. Yeah, it's interesting how I was the pedigree in this film, but there's something else I learned about this film. I was sort of just reading some little bits and notes. Although this is called The Day After, this was circulated before it was broadcast, which is, I think, where Reagan saw it. And it was presented and broadcast or projected at certain events. And it gave way to a movement that they called The Day Before, which was a movement that grew up to try and prevent anything from like this happening, which is kind of interesting. So it really did have an impact on American politics. This film was utilized in a way. It's fascinating.
Well, and it includes a note at the end that asks for exactly that. And you know, that's worth mentioning because there are very few movies, very few comics, very few novels that have ever had a real impact on the world, right? You think of like Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. At least like JFK caused, you know, some files to be opened and released. Uh-huh. There's really only a handful of movies that have ever had that kind of effect. And this is one of them.
Yeah. And I understand why. I'm not going to lie. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's most definitely, it's a film of two halves and you have to appreciate that.
Well, it's a disaster movie, structural, right?
Yes.
It introduces the ensemble cast. It's just that the disaster is nuclear Armageddon. Like, that's amazing.
Well, I was kind of, I was thinking it's just over 2 hours long. And in my head, as I was watching it and it started, I was like, I wonder how soon are they going to give you that nuclear event? And what's it going to be? You know, because again, I'd never seen this before. I'm coming to this sort of like, you know, decades later. And the one thing playing in my head, and we'll talk about, is the Terminator 2. To me, Terminator 2, the nightmare that Sarah Connor has in Terminator 2, where she, I don't know if you remember, I think it's in the main film, bulked up sort of like military Sarah Connor walks up to a fence and she looks over and the younger version of herself is there with young John. And then the nuclear cloud sort of like sprouts up, and then you have the wave come out, and then they all turn to ash and get blown away, and the skeleton's there on the fence. And that terrified me in, you know, in the early 90s. So I was like, oh, it's not going to stand up to that. Oof, it didn't need to. Like, this film, like, yeah.
You know, the thing that amazes me about this movie, and, you know, we've talked about some movies this season that have had good ideas but, you know, been poorly executed. You think about, like, you know, we just talked about Day and His Dog recently.
Yeah,
and you A Boy and His Dog. Flat. A Boy and His Dog.
So. Yeah.
And, you know, that has more of a budget than this does. Like, you know, this takes every shortcut imaginable associated with cheap budgets and cheap movies. You know, there are shots that are embarrassing. There are lines that are embarrassing. There's a lot of stock footage, you know, like characters look off and it's like, is this a 1950s movie? Like, characters look off and you see like footage of a rocket launch.
It's grainy. It's, like, it's clearly from the 1960s news footage. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, this has every cheap, bad, sort of painful decision like that. And somehow it works. Somehow it is so affecting.
Yeah.
It is just, you know, we have watched people being eaten. We have watched people, you know, being dismembered. We have watched so many horrors over the course of these movies. And somehow this movie, with no budget, reusing footage and doing cheap special effects, is so powerfully affecting. And that is, to me, my biggest takeaway from the film.
Well, what
I don't know how it does it.
The thing to me is it builds, and I think it's brutal in its, not just its depiction of the event, but the aftermath. And I think there's some stuff we will talk about. But I think the reason it works is, we talked about, when we talked about on the Patreon, I used a phrase, the cozy cataclysm, where it's sort of, you know, yes, it's the end of the world, but everyone's still able to sort of have a cup of tea and a biscuit, and they're still sat around knitting and all that shit. You know what I mean? It's like, it's the end of the world, but it generally still feels like, you know, this was a term that was used for disaster sort of things of the 60s and 70s in British TV, was, you know, the cozy cataclysm or the cozy catastrophe. But this has got that same thing. It kind of sets you up to expect that. The first hour is all very, like, you know, Home on the Prairie almost. Like, you know, obviously modern depictions of that, but it's kind of like, you know, down home.
Worried about
sort
sports
of,
and, just, you know, local in the background, this tension's escalating in Berlin.
Exactly. You know, it does it really well in that, like, as you say, it's a disaster movie. You've got pockets of people, you know, you've introduced to, there's a generational family where the daughter is going to be marrying this other guy, and they're getting ready for the wedding, but she's still living at home. And then they go off to, you know, there's these people in college, and one of them's coming home, and there's all these groups of people, and you're setting them up, and you're seeing just days in their life. Like, it's kind of like cozy, it's comfy, like, you know, the everyday trials and tribulations that we all face. You know, there's sort of and when the first sort of 20 minutes is exactly that, like, it's very mundane. It's incredibly mundane, intentionally so. Like, it's introducing these characters in sort of very sort of mundane everyday ways, you know, it's the students, lots of other stuff. And as you say, the tension sort of ratchets up. Like, it's literally like that, the minutes to midnight, all of a sudden you hear it on a news footage and everyone starts getting a little bit panicky and starts talking about it. The college students are asking questions, the college professor's making comments, and then you'll see a news footage, and all of a sudden there's something else going on, and all of a sudden all the guys are, and then you've got, there's the black couple, and the guy sort of, who's a soldier, and he's called back to the base. And he's going,
and of course, he says, look, it's just, we're running the checks twice, right?
Exactly. It's just a trial. Right. Don't worry. But she's, you know, but his wife's saying, but you're taking everything. He's like, well, I've got to. It's a drill. We've got to do it properly. And again, like, you know, they all get there, and it gets ratcheted up a little bit more. And then all of a sudden people are going to the supermarket and panic buying, and they're buying bunches of stuff. And you start to see
That's
how.
That's really an affecting scene.
Oh, now. Yeah.
I mean, of course, we've been through it with COVID, yeah. right? You know.
But one of my favorite scenes in this that really, again, I think this goes to Nicholas Meyer and how he sort of shoots some of this to be simple but effective. Mm-hmm. One of the main characters is the college student, the blonde college student, who is kind of like the main, for the first hour, is the main character. He's going to be marrying this girl. You know, he's this good-looking sort of like, you know, farm boy. He's all sort of like, everyone loves him. They all go off to church every Sunday. And they're in a hairdresser's, and he's getting a haircut for his wedding. Mm-hmm. That's what he's there for. So he's like, oh, tidy it up. And John Lithgow, who I love John Lithgow and everything he does.
I do too.
Yeah, he's amazing.
And I don't know why. I don't know why. I just love amazing. Lithgow. Yeah. And but he doesn't get enough to do here. But,
no, yeah. but amazing.
But he sits in the background of the...
The hairdressers, and they're saying, like, and he said, well, it's just a, you know, it's just a nothing. They have people that will deal with these things. And then he pipes up, and I think he's a professor in this, and he sort of says, well, yes, but, and then he starts saying, but, you know, this has happened, and then that's happened. And then they said, well, and then he says, but we're in the middle of nowhere. And there's a line that he says, in a nuclear war, there's no such thing as the middle of nowhere. And it's kind of like you see the in the reflection, this kid's face, where he's like, there's a true sort of dawning of the realization of like, oh, shit. Like, this is what I'm seeing in the streets is legit. Like, people should have a right to be panicked. And I just thought that was a really small but effective scene. The one thing it doesn't say, because he talks about populated areas, but the other thing they don't talk about is not only he mentions that they live next to a nuclear silo, which is one mm-hmm. thing, but they're also farmland. So where else are you going? What, you know, if you want to cripple a country, you irradiate its farmland. So there's all that, and it just keeps this rat. That first hour is that ticking to it, and you don't realize it. And I love that about that first hour. I thought it was really well done. I don't know, sorry, I was going on, but I just thought it was really well done.
No, I love everything you said. And, you know, there's this kind of, like, broadcast going on and special reports. And, you know, I love the way people react to that news. You know, it's all very realistic. You know, I love that ratcheting effect, right? And the audience, this is the kind of, like, the ticking clock that you talk about, right? Mm. Like, the audience feels the tension that the characters don't, yes. right? Like, the audience is like, pay attention, right? You know, and one of the effects of these mundane sequences is to, first of all, to humanize and characterize the people who are going to die terribly, yeah. but also to present the futility of making plans, right?
Yes.
Like, all of our plans, I'm going to get a new, you know, air cleaner for my apartment, you know, like, right. We all know there are circumstances that might happen in which this is insane to be doing right now, and it's yeah. totally out of your hand.
I'm getting new air filters. Good for you. Air filters yeah. aren't going to do anything against radiation. Right.
Yeah, or like, you know, the getting married, you know, the big game, you know, all these kinds of things that we think matter.
Yeah.
And they matter, but they matter presuming a tsunami doesn't come and destroy where I live, or a nuclear apocalypse doesn't happen. And we all live under that kind of existential threat, right? We're all used to it. But, you know, I remember very much growing up in the 80s, and I'm a little older than you, and we did duck and cover drills.
Yeah.
And we really thought that the world was going to end. And when I talked to my parents about it, they said this thing about the military bases, where they said, you know, son, you know, we live near an Air Force base. It will be a nuclear target and we will die. And I said, you know, that's terrible. Shouldn't we move? And they said, no, you want to die. Mm. If it happens, you don't want to survive. Understanding that, you know, having to understand that as a 6-year-old kid, you know, like, like that was something we lived through in the 80s. And I yeah. know a lot of people talk about like the Cuban Missile Crisis and, you know, the trauma of growing up in the 50s and 60s and stuff, but there was a different kind of trauma in the 80s. And I especially love that conversation between the doctor and his wife about the Cuban Missile Crisis and how they've seen life. And everybody will say this, right? Everybody says, you know, we've heard this and it hasn't happened. You know, I remember when COVID was happening and I met with one of my friends, and I knew it was the last time I was going to see him for some time. And I was following the CDC and I was like, oh, it's real. And, you know, I mean, he's a lawyer. He's, you know, an educated guy. And I was walking through a supermarket just staring at people thinking, why isn't there a run on the supermarket, right? Like, do these people not know what this is all going to look like in a week? And they didn't. And I met him and I said, let me tell you what I'm hearing, you know, and he said, well, we went through SARS, we went through, you know, one concern after another, you know, and I'm like, let me tell you what's going to happen in the next few months, you know, and, but it was just this way that our brains say, you know, of course, I mean, he's super busy, he's trying cases, right? You know, he doesn't have time to pay attention to this. And it's so easy to say, well, you know, I've had a long life. I've been through a lot of scares, you know. Is this going to be the one, you know, that takes us out? You know, it's easy to kind of dismiss it based on experience. But some of the horror of nuclear war, right, the horror of a real disaster is, no, you know, one disaster can destroy everything.
Well, there's a couple of characters, the minor characters in this, that sort of fit that mold. I mean, you know, we get main characters that do things, but within the university, when you meet the sort of young Steve Guttenberg, and I think that's where John Lithgow works, there's a couple of other students, and there's a young woman with, you know, wearing glasses, and she's very much of the opinion of, like, well, why would they start this? Who would? Of course they went, this isn't going to happen. Like, it'll get to that point, and then everyone will get around the table, and we're going to be okay. And that's her kind of opinion throughout. Like, she's the one that's going, well, no, this is ridiculous. And then she has, there's a friend of his, a friend of hers, who's much more into the detail. It's going, like, well, who would fire first and where would this be? And then it jumps to him. I don't want to get to the event yet or the attack yet, but when the missiles do fire, and it's really well done, because it's sort of like all of a sudden these missiles are taking off and you just see these streams of smoke. And she, in her response, she sees this is, oh, they must be these smaller missiles. And it's just John Lithgow, the look on John Lithgow's face, this professor who just says, no, those are from the silos. They're going to travel to nuclear targets and they're going to get there in about half an hour. And he looks back and the other person says, so the others have launched. He says, probably. And you know then that they've got half an hour. That's it. Like, if we've launched, they've launched. That's it. And it's sort of that realization of, like, as you said, like, you know, it just takes this one event. Like, you know, you can get through 100 of these, and on the 101st, that's it. That's the one that wipes you out. And you can feel the weight of that throughout as this thing sort of cranks up. And I just think that's, you know, it's really, really well done in that set. And as you say, it jumps to these different bits and pieces where it'll have, like, you know, people at home and they're sort of, they're doing things, or they'll run on the sort of the supermarket eventually, and then it'll cut to an army base, but you never see enough of an army base or an army scenario to really get what's going on. You just get, like, snippets of information, and it feels more and more tense in the army base. The thing that this doesn't do, which I appreciate and glad it doesn't, you never see Washington. There's never a scene of, like, and here's the president on the big red telephone or anything like that. Like, it's, you know, that's not information that people are going to get. And I love the fact that there's a big part of this is people having that discussion, that when it does, it is going to happen. It's like, there's a news broadcast, and I think it says a nuclear device has been set off in a
airburst over Europe. Enemy troops.
Yeah. And they're like, who's done that? What's gone on? Well, how's it happened? Da, da, da. And it's the confusion. It's the lack of information. And so the fact is, we're not getting information. So if you were in the Oval Office or something, you'd have to be giving that information. And the fact is, okay, we are too distant from that. We don't need that information. We're never going to have that information. So we're not going to give the audience that information either. So there's constantly that sense of, when's it coming? We can feel it cranking up. When's it coming? And I think I really appreciate how well it does that constantly.
Yeah, I mean, this is the man on the ground's point of view.
Yeah.
This is not about the drama in Washington. It's not about the soldiers. It's about, you know, it's no coincidence that this is set largely in Kansas, right? I mean, this is Superman's home, right?
Oh, yes.
This is the salt of the earth, you know, the predominantly white middle class.
Small town America.
You know,
yeah.
Right. And that's an excellent choice, you know. It really drives home this plot. And I was thinking as you were talking, like, for as much as I'll defend him for what he does do well, you know, imagine how horrible this would be directed by Michael Bay, right? It would all be, you know, dramatic picking up the red phone and, you know, tons of soldiers deploying shot like pornography. And, you know, this is it's the restraint of this film in not doing that, in focusing on common people that makes this work. And that denialism that you talk about with the missiles, like, if you've ever been in situations like a car crash, right? You've been to an accident or something, and you see people just denying reality in front of them. You know, you see some of this. And it's just amazing how, you know, again, like, on such a low budget, whether it's Meyer or whatever, I mean, this film touches those emotional chords. And it doesn't largely do it through, like, there's no soliloquy. There's no, like, you know, like, this is your actor moment. It's going to win you an Emmy, you know? Like, there's no, this is such an unshowy movie. But it knows how to drive home those psychological moments, those emotional moments, with pinpoint accuracy.
Well, I think the main center of this family, there's two main centers for this film. One is Jason Robards as Dr. Oakes, who's sort of the head of this family, and he works at this hospital. And then the other one is the family that Steve Guttenberg ends up staying with. And but at the beginning, they sort of perform these two sort of tandem areas. They know each other. Like, you know, this is all part of small. One of them lives in Kansas City, but his hospital is just outside this small town, and so on and so forth. And then there's this black couple, and you follow the main soldier. So it's giving you all that information, and like you said, there are little moments throughout. None of it's like Oscar. Like you say, this isn't sort of your sort of, like you say, you know, this is your monologue. Give you, you know, this is your Oscar moment. There's just lots of little moments. And some of those little moments are so good, like, you know, little conversations. Or one of my favorite ones is towards the end when they're like, something's coming. The farmer who sort of, you know, it's his house, his wife's making the bed. And she's just sort of straightening the sheets, and she keeps faffing with the sheets. And he says, we've got to go. And he just grabs her, and she just wails and turns into like to hysterics. And as you say, it's that sort of like the denialism has been there for all this time. And all of a sudden it's like, look, there is no denying this anymore. We've got to go down into the shelter. And it's sort of like, you know, those little moments, as you say, sort of, you know, constant little moments, is just so well done. There's those touches, even going, oh God, this, you know, as a viewer, you know, like, you know, it's about to get bad. And then, but you see that they sort of know it more and more by the time. Let's talk about the event then. The hour mark. It comes at the hour mark. It comes at like 1 hour, 2 minutes. Very well done.
You imagine watching this on TV, right? Like, this is the most watched TV movie in history, okay?
But it's not like, again, there's no like hold your breath moment. In, you know, you talk about the Michael Bay sort of approach. There'd be the button has been pressed. Like, there'd be a gasp. There'd be the hold your breath moment around the sort of the war room or whatever, you know, where everyone would stand still. There is not that. You see, you hear this thing that's happened, and all of a sudden, then soon after, you just see this thing where it goes to a military base, there's some activity, and all of a sudden, bang, the American missiles are being launched.
Well, you do see the keys being turned.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Which is brilliant. I mean, I love, there's something so effective about opening the hatches and taking the tape off and soldiers following orders and commands, you know. And of course, you think this is madness, right? Yeah. Like, you know, look at how orderly we are about Armageddon. Right? Yeah. Like,
but it's not like, but from the yeah. families, from the sort of the, you said the everyday folk, there's no hold your breath moment. Like, they don't know this mm-hmm. is coming. It's only like they're all doing their usual thing. Like, they're up on the roof having a cigarette. They're, you know, mowing the lawn. They're riding their bike. They're doing whatever. And all of a sudden you see those plumes of smoke going up and the missiles are going and everybody's like, oh, like, you know, Christ, what's going on? And then there's a little bit of, you know, there's a little bit of stuff, but then it turns and you get the doctor, Dr. Oakes, is driving his car to get back to Kansas City. And all the cars are trying to get out. And all of a sudden, boom, you just get this. First off, you get a flash overhead and it emits the electromagnetic pulse that we all now know. And everything dies. Like, cars die, hospital equipment dies, you know, TVs die, everything.
And that EMP effect was relatively new, you know, in the 80s, right? I mean, like, this was a relatively new idea.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like a year later where it's in Dark Knight Returns, you know, but which was when I was first exposed to it. But, you know, this was new stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you get the mushroom clouds.
Yes. Yeah. And it just goes to like about a 4-minute sequence of just things being vaporized, like buildings being leveled. And you see, it clocks into like stock footage. It does use it, but it's very, very effective. And you know, this is very low budget. It doesn't have the special effects to do much, but it has this way of utilizing color and light along with the silhouettes of skeletons. Like, people are sort of like silhouetted as a skeleton, and then it's just boom. And it's just, and it's all the people you've been following. Like, you don't know who's going to get it. And there's others you're just never going to see again. Like, you don't see them eradicated, but you're just never going to see them again. It's a gut punch of a moment.
Yeah, it's pretty effective. And it's surprisingly effective. And I think that it's more effective because the movie's been so muted. You know, there has been this ratcheting up, but I mean, even the missiles rising into the air, I mean, you can see that they're drawn on, you know, like every second there's an additional little bit drawn on.
Yeah.
You know, and it's been very muted. And then you have this sort of like torrent of destruction, and you see people sort of running and being destroyed and families, and you know, one thing after another, and I don't know how it manages to be so effective. You know, it's just that sort of movie magic of what works and what doesn't. And what works is not the CGI. What works is not, you know, it has nothing to do with budget. It has to do with editing. It has to do with just, you know, capturing that combination of audio and visual that kind of hits you right in your soul. And this movie does it, and I don't know how it does it. Even in that destruction sequence, it's like, you know, what you're seeing is very limited, but boy, is it effective.
And I think that's the you say, it's not a special effect spectacular, which, you know, we can expect today in modern film. They'd show all the bits and pieces, and they could show all kinds of like gory, you know, incredible things. But it's just the knowledge of it. Like, it gives you, it's this thing of just saying, like, you know, yeah, this, you know, we can't afford this, but this is what you're going to experience. Like, this is what's going to happen. And it gives you that insight that you say is just very effective. And I think because it's set up those people incredibly well, it kind of, it, you know, it's kind of like, oh, Christ. Like any good disaster film, you don't know who's going to cop it. And the one for me, is I've assumed that the blonde lad who was in the hairdressers is going to be is remaining a main character, and he's riding on his bike, and his bike packs up, and you're like, oh no, like get to cover. Nope, doesn't make it. Bumf, off he goes. And it does it with several others as well. And so you're sort of left in a place where the holding your breath moment, instead of coming before it, comes after it, because after it you are sort of stuck there going like, okay, well, what does come on the day after? Like, who is left? And I can imagine if this was, you know, on American TV, like there are adverts in this. Like, if you were sort of watching this and an advert came just after the devastation of this, I'd have been fuming. Oh,
yeah. Well, you know, this is one problem with the advertising model is, you know, every once in a while you have something brilliant and you think, you know, for example, Cops, you know, has been accused of being racist and promoting the police and police brutality and all of this and ideas of black people and minorities as criminals. And, you know, the makers of Cops, you know, it's off the air now, but, you know, always said, yeah, we're liberals. We're totally aware of this. We're doing something that, you know, we are bothered by. You know, why don't you show people who aren't criminals? Why don't you show us? And they say, well, cannot figure out how to sell Colgate toothpaste while doing it.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, we say, part of why this works is that it eschews all of those Hollywood cliches of, you know, the heroes and it's all going to end well. You just have to try and feel deeply enough and, you know, for it to really work out. And, you know, you want the hero, the happy ending and all of that. You know, the heroes all die here.
Yeah.
And you can see this being a hard sell at network for who the hell wants to advertise Colgate after, why, you know, to so people who just watched the Atomic.
So we've got the 1 hour 10 advertising. We've got 3 minutes at 1 hour 10. Who wants a 30-second slot?
Well, you know, we did Twilight Zone. This is a huge part of what he talked about. Of like, you know, how do I, you know, the advertisers have to be able to sell their product. And you know, it's a problem. But it's, no, it's, I mean, it's hard to imagine those commercials going on. Like, you know,
I almost want to watch this. I almost
check a vacation to Disney's ad. You know, I mean, it's like that doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah. Now I've seen it as a full film. I'd love to try and actually see a part of this with advertisements in, just to see like who lost their job a week later when this was broadcast, and someone comes in and like. You did what? You bought what advertising space? Oh, Christ. Yeah.
Come on, down to Pottery Barn. You know, like, I just saw the looting scene.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yes, Olive Garden, straight after the shopping sort of spree.
Yeah, well, all these your family here.
Yeah. So it is, it's fascinating, but it does go into the day after, and again, we get like three or four different tracks. Like, and this is, again, it focuses in. I feel the second half is a lot more focused.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you really only like maybe like two, I think it's two or three sort of very specific stories that are going on. There's the Dr. Oakes in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And then the family that Steve Guttenberg is with. Those are the main two, and you sort of get like a wider community sort of story of what's going on. But again, this thing at the hospital where like people just start turning up and they've got you know, or the other one, sorry, is the African-American, the black soldier. And
who has left? There's this great conversation as he's leaving the base beforehand where it's like, are you gonna shoot me, you know, like we need to go down there, you know, as military. This is the one thing you wouldn't see in a Michael Bay movie, right? Is the military discipline breaking down, right?
I mean,
which is not supposed to happen. But
no, but he makes a good point because he sort of says, well, what do we do now? And everyone's like, we stay here and continue to guard. He's like, guard what? Holes in the ground. Like, the missiles have gone. So yeah, and they do, like, he ends up leaving. He goes AWOL to get to his wife.
Right.
And, you know, he becomes a sort of, and this is why I like this, the way that this sets up these three, is the hospital shows sort of, like, you know, there's an element of humanity, but it shows you, starts to show you, like, the medical side of all this other stuff, like what's going on, what they've got to deal with, you know, the trauma of being a frontline medic in this situation. With the family, you get this sort of thing of being trapped in a basement, like a shelter. They've got like a, they've got a nuclear shelter, and the consequence of that, like there's some psychological breakdown and all kinds of stuff there, and then those start to interweave. And then the soldier is, he's the sort of crossing the country, like he's trying to make his way to his wife, and he meets all these different people along the way, and a lot of it provides you with those different chunks of information to give you a full picture of what's going on. And continues to be incredibly well done.
And incredibly brutal.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Without special effects, without, you know, watching people's faces melt. I mean, this is practical effects. They're putting makeup on people, but you're seeing, like, these terrible radiation burns. People's, you know, I mean, their hair falling out. Their,
radiation their skin. Sickness. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, really just appalling. You know, you're looking at people and just thinking, not only are you going to die, but this is going to be terrible.
Yeah. Well, the hospital in particular, like, you know, you have these two doctors. The other one is, I need to find his name. I can't find him in the cast. It's kind of annoying. But you have the other point that's really interesting is, because you have like Dr. Oakes, but he has a Japanese doctor that he works with. I can't find him in here, but basically, there's one of the boy from the young boy from the family that with the shelter, when the bombs went off, the flash goes, and they say like, "Don't look at the flash," and of course he already has. So he's had, like, you know, flash burns on his eyes, and he's sort of all wrapped up. He's been blinded by it. But they have this conversation later on. He says, "Oh, you know, you're Italian." You know, and he's like, "Yeah, all right, I'm Italian." You know, like they have a bit of a joke between themselves. But he has this, there's a thing about, I forget what the boy says later on about, you know, well, you know, this has never happened before. Has this ever happened before or something? And you can sort of see that. You know, obviously, this Japanese doctor sort of doesn't want to go, "Yeah, well, you kind of flattened my, you know, ancestral home." There's definitely that sort of, there's that kind of weight to some of the things that are going on as well. That, like, you know, not only we know, this isn't a case of we didn't know what would happen. Like, we've seen this happen. Like, we you know, we have to recognize the devastation.
We all knew.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that we all knew that anger, you're supposed to be angry.
Yeah.
You know, you're supposed to see the madness of this, right? This is obviously a lot worse than COVID, but I mean, so much of my anger during lockdown was, you all knew this was coming. You know, like, none of this is surprising. You know, I've been prepared for this my whole life. We all knew we were late for this. What are you doing denying it? What are you doing going to, you know, concerts? You know, like you people are fucking crazy, you know. That sense of, we all knew. We were busy getting married and doing all these things. We didn't put pressure on our Congress people to stop this, you know. Obviously, that's the advocacy part of this, but it's very subtle in the film. It's not, you know, it lets the depiction, you know, speak for itself. And it really is just a kind of a litany of horrors. You mentioned the kid who's got his eyes burned, and as they take him to the doctor, to that same Asian doctor, he is sort of being, it's like a horse and buggy, you know, and he can't see, and he says, you know, what's going on? And they say, oh, the, you know,
usual
cows, you know, nothing remarkable. And of course, you already know those cows are all dead in the field, and the camera pulls back And here you know, one of the many times that you do get a wide shot that is really effective. And you see, not only are there tons of cows dead, but they're throwing bodies to the side, right? I mean, he's feet away from just, you know, a score of bodies. And again and again, just these horrors, but these very understated horrors.
Yeah. Well, it's that thing of, like you say, that scene is the bodies and the cows, but there's also like the soldiers are back out and they're just putting the bodies on the back of a truck, aren't they? And it's just sort of loading them up to be taken away. Yeah,
and
that's what I'm
hospital
saying.
Has to decide, you know, right before the doctor collapses, they're talking to him about, we have to do mass graves, you know.
Yeah.
The morgue's been full, you know. And of course, we've gone through this too, you know. I mean, you know.
And you see the mass graves. I think one of the things that's interesting is Steve Guttenberg's character, called Stephen, which is weird, but he takes the young boy. He sort of says, look, I, you know, he's saved by this family taken into their shelter. And the daughter, this is the family daughter that was going to marry the other guy. And she has like this emotional breakdown where she's like, no, I've got to get out of here. I've got to get to him. I was going to get married. And you say about this idea of the fragility of what we consider to be the mundane. She's obsessed with like, well, I was going to wear this dress and I was going to get married and I was going to have this and that sort of thing. And she breaks out of the basement and runs across the farmland and stuff. And it's like you say, it's just like there's two dead cows. There's, you know, the land is just arid. Like it's just gone. It's just everything's, the crops are all gone and everything. And she sort of, you know, she's gone like stir crazy. She's hysterical. And he takes her down, you know, holds her down and brings her back to the basement. But then she's, you know, this thing is like, she can't stay there anymore. She gets like, it's like cabin fever or anything. But the psychological breakdown, the psychological realization of like, this has happened. Like, there's a new status quo now, and it's not a good one. So she goes into like a catatonic state, you find. But then she gets taken to the hospital. And again, everyone gets sort of separated, and Steven ends up helping. Because what you got to do, you got to, you know, help. And he's there, digging the graves and putting the bodies in. And I thought this is interesting because this is pre, you know, the next year Steve Guttenberg would become a star. Like 1984's Police Academy is what really put him on the map. The, you know, but as an actor, like, he doesn't do himself, and you know, he's good in this.
No.
Like he's not, but like he doesn't hold it. There's no ego in this film. Like, you know, he starts to sort of suffer from radiation sickness. He loses his hair. He has bruising on his face, and it sort of, as it propels through the film. And it's just fascinating to see how every character starts to suffer from, you know, they really do play it down. Like Russell, like the Dr. Oakes, is getting more and more frail. His hair is getting thinner and thinner. He's looking grayer and grayer. Like, it's just, it's the sort of a slow build horror film of everything that's going on. Like, they just keep trying to live and to push, but they just, you know, the you know why. Well, I don't want to get right to the end, but there's just several scenes. But like you say, they've talked about mass graves, they've talked about all these different bits and pieces. But the wider story is they go out to the farmland, and you see this, the farmers are all sat about, and they've been brought together, and they have instructions from the government that says, "Oh, we've got to get back. You know, anything that, you know, we've got
a great
to,
scene, right?
We've got to,
here's
we've got
what to do.
Here's what to do. We've got to get rid of, you know, scrape away your topsoil, the top, you know, however, just scrape away the topsoil, focus on building human feed crops, nothing for animal feed, just human feed crops. Here's the things that are most resilient, da da da." And all of a sudden the questions come, and they're like, okay, cool. How much topsoil do I need to get rid of to be effective? Like, how do I know it's not irradiated? Well, the first 3 or 4 inches. And the guy's like, cool, 150 acres of 3 or 4 inches. Of soil. Where's that going to go?
Right. Yeah. And it's just going to blow back. You know, this is not going to work. And what's the quality of the topsoil underneath that topsoil? You know, like there's, you know, these farmers have very practical questions about this.
Yeah.
And you just see, it's not that nobody's in charge, but somebody's in charge. But, you know, the other thing is that you see not everybody's going to follow this.
Yeah.
They're dubious. They think this sounds like a government pamphlet. All along, you've seen this kind of like suspicion about, you know, these government reports about the looming nuclear war.
Mm.
And, you know, it reminds me, as we're in this kind of like post-fact landscape now with media and Trump. First of all, it's always been that way, that people have always doubted reality. But it would be so much worse now, you know, like there'd be, you know, InfoWars would be broadcasting, you know, that topsoil's fine. In fact, it cures you. You need to ingest it. You know, yes. I mean, but people are dumb and people, you know, you cannot corral people and get them, especially Westerners, to follow this advice. And you just see this is going to be a disaster.
Well, yeah, and but I like the like you said, you know, you say it's such a fantastic scene because it does. But it's the fact that like the questions are quite simply practical, when it's like, well, where do I put this? Who's going to dig a hole for it? Like you said, it's going to blow back. What happens with this? Like, it's clear that like the government instruction could even say they even call out and said this sounds like government nonsense, hasn't been thought through. That they haven't taken information or guidance from the right people. And so it's a very small scene. It's quite a self-contained scene. And it's just sort of, it's very, very effective. The other one that I find interesting is the church, which is kind of what results in Stephen taking the brother and sister to the hospital. But you have people, again, like in a decimated church, a cross hanging, like partial burnt cross hanging from sort of, string. And this sort of, this priest or this pastor sort of giving this sermon. But it's kind of like even he's like looking about with tears in his eyes going like, what am I saying?
Yeah, and he's suffering badly from radiation poisoning. And clearly his flock is too. I mean, they're basically exposed to the elements in this devastated church. And he praises God and thanks God and thanks God for destroying the people who have destroyed the earth. And it's not long after that that you hear the president on the radio.
Yes.
So
yes.
You know the rich people and the politicians are fine, right? This is all bullshit that he's saying.
And that speech is
pedestrian.
But it's pitch perfect.
Yes. Yes.
For that very reason, because it says, like, you know, I, like you, have felt a personal loss in this moment of national tragedy. And it's all that. And it's all very, like you say, very pat, very sort of, you know,
Government speak.
And you see people crowding around, listening to it. But like, it sort of pans out again and you see the chaos of what's going on. And you're like, yeah, like you said, the rich are in bunkers. He's fine. You know, the government's fine. It's these people trying to scrape 3 inches of topsoil off their land that's going to be the real problem.
Well, and I think that the church scene, you know, for me, you know, as an American, I mean, you know, these characters represent the sort of like salt of the earth.
Yeah.
You know, the real America, quote unquote, a phrase I hate. But I mean, you know, this is that kind of Americana romanticized thing. And part of it is the church. Part of it is, you know, those are Christian people. And the religion offers no comfort.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't help but think that part of the response to this movie, you know, from some Americans, you know, who are predominantly Christian, is not only to see the horror, but to see the horror of sort of, how can I profess and call myself Christian when I see, you know, because I don't believe, but if somebody does, and I sort of know the American mentality, that American mentality sees that religious scene and says, belief in God is going to be destroyed by this event.
Mm.
In some ways, that is even more horrifying than the physical destruction and all of the death. Right, that not just that you have a responsibility as a Christian, but I think on a more palpable level for, you know, an American audience to just think, nobody's going to believe after this, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if a society does survive, it's not just our way of life that's destroyed, but our entire faith has been, you know, rendered moot.
I don't think that would be the case, though. I think we'd end up with the, we've ended up in this position because we sinned too much.
Mm-hmm. Sadly.
You'd end up with the ultra...
The Falwell.
Yeah, the
explanation
ultra, exactly.
For, you know,
the ultra evangelical kind of, you know, outcome.
Well, you know, it was those rainbow flags that attracted those bombs, right? It wasn't those politicians. I don't know if you know this, but, you know, God hates rainbow flags, and he will send nukes to eradicate them.
Well, apparently, you know, Putin has had
God is so loving.
That's it. Well, Putin has had gaydar installed on the end of all nuclear weapons, apparently. So that's exactly what it's about.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. But yes, that's what I think we're going. There was two other things I wanted to sort of to draw attention to, which we discuss as we come to the end.
Can I back up? I just want to point out, you know, when the daughter goes crazy and she goes upstairs, there's a whole thing with the dog they haven't let downstairs. And you see the dog's body and her, you know, wedding dress lying there. And there's a lot that just kind of like brings that emotion home, you know, that devastated landscape outside. The other thing is, you mentioned, you know, the family that travels, you know, and takes the daughter, you know, to the hospital. You never see what happens to the dog, but, you know, she's sick. She's been outside. She's in need of medical care. You do see, you know, you see that person who's throwing bodies into the pit. One of them is in the same blanket, right, that she was wrapped in, right? And so the implication is, you know, she's died.
Yes.
They're not bringing her back. And they say to the boy who's blind, you know, which is a nice metaphor, right? We're all going back, right? Mm. And lie to him, you know, and you know... Again, like, this is all actually really subtly done, right?
Yeah.
But boy, that feels like a gut punch, you know, like, we're all going to die, you know, but like, yeah, your sister's already dead.
Well, there's the scene when, you know, Steve does go into that basketball, the sort of the hall, the gym hall, and he's making his way through all those people, and again, wide shot, like it pulls out, and that's a full hall full of extras, like people lying on each other, lying on cot beds, and all looking forlorn and all kinds of bits and pieces. And he finds, I was never sure if it was the sister or not, but he finds that cot bed with a woman sort of lying in it. He obviously recognised from somewhere, and they have this conversation, and she's very, like, her hair's all falling out. She's looking very pallid, and the makeup effects in this are very good. I've got to say, like, you know, for what the money they had. And he says, you're looking, and, you know, Stephen says, you're looking great. And she sort of laughs it off a little bit. And he says, you know, like, sort of like, speak for yourself. And he takes his hat off. He's wearing a baseball cap. And he takes the cap off, and you can see, like, just these strands of hair that are left, like, you know, bits and pieces. And again,
he's
like,
wearing the cap because he's bald, basically.
Yeah, basically,
And she says, I'm losing my hair, you know, my beauty's gone, you know. And he's like, yeah, I'm so much worse.
Yeah. And it's but again, you're like, and then it sort of pans across. There's all these just sort of like forlorn people in different, you know, stages of radiation sickness, looking very ill. And that scene really bothered me. Like, just that hall full of people was very, very effective. But
you know what it is? It's the Gone with the Wind scene, right? With the soldiers, where the camera just pans out and pans out and pans out. And this is a very effective technique for mass casualty events.
Yeah.
Right? It was actually used in the 1989 invasion comic of DC, where you see all the superheroes, you know, in medical beds.
Yeah.
What gets me about that scene is him hobbling, looking for her.
Yeah.
You know, when you think, how do you search for somebody, right? Like, there's just this mass of people. Mm. I mean, just looking for
no records, no organization. Yeah. No, you know, I want to talk about the Black Soldier, because I think his story is really cool. So he runs from the base, and then we return to him, and he's sort of wrapped in a blanket, and he starts meeting people on the road, and he's asking, like, you know, what about this place? What about that place? And they're all like, it's gone. Like, these places are gone. And it's there's no sort of discussion. Like, these are people that have been, they've beaten, they are broken. And there's kids there and some other stuff. And this group is sort of, we'll come back to what this group eventually does, but just this moment of, like, there's one guy that he gets to a point where there's like a water pump, and there's one guy that's trying to get to water and keeps getting pushed away and beaten up and stuff. And he intercedes and gets water and helps this guy. And to him, it's like, once more, if I can do one act of kindness, one good thing, I can, you know, not redeem myself. It's not about redemption, but it's like, I can hold on to something that shows that we're still, you know, good or normal or whatever. And he gets to like a registration point, or I don't know what it is, you know, for the hospital, maybe, I think. And there's a guy at a table, and he's like, I'm so-and-so, you know, da-da-da, I've got this, and this, we've got this bruising, and this is the person he's picked up. And the guy at the desk is just so sort of like dismissive. And he eventually says,
zoned out.
Yeah, oh, just zoned out. It's just sort of like, he's just filling the paperwork again and again at the same. And the soldier says, I know we've got radiation sickness, but is there anything we can do? Is there anywhere we can go? And then again, it sort of looks up, and you just see all these people in like lines and stuff. And he's like, no. And he doesn't say anything. He's just like, he just looks at them like, are you daft? What do you think, you know, we're supposed to do? It's just that sense of just being overwhelmed with, you know, this sense of like misery and just sort of hopelessness. Like, you know, the soldier tried to do something to gain a little bit of hope, but ends up entering a situation that is just endlessly hopeless. And again, that was like, geez, like, this film's so kind of downbeat, like, but I'm so impressed with how it keeps, it doesn't want to repeat itself, and it could easily do so, but it keeps hitting you with these sort of moments, and you're just sort of like, oh yeah, no, that's bloody hell, that's not good either.
Well, you talk about hopelessness, I think of powerlessness.
Yes.
You know, I mean, and I think of like the most frustrating thing is when there's nothing you can do, right? Yeah. I mean, if you have a loved one who's sick and you think, I can take them to the hospital, right? Like, you know, okay, I've done my thing. I you know, like, but it's in those moments when somebody is inconsolable and you say everything you can and you know you can't make any difference mm-hmm. to this person who's suffering. That's where the heartbreak really starts. Mm-hmm. You know, in the sense, like, you know, it's hope, but it's also what he can do to have some kind of power over his circumstances to help this guy.
Yeah.
And we all want to believe that we have some kind of, I mean, this power, this gets at the, you know, the American dream, right? The myth of, you know, you can build your life and be prosperous and talk about, well, you know, the death of that. What does it mean if you have no power over whether you and your family survive? You know, there is a way in which that powerlessness that's dramatized strikes, you know, the heart of those ideals that make America mean anything.
I think that's, yeah, I think this comes to the end of the film actually as well. The that idea, because the end of the film is that the doctor, Dr. Oakes, he's been very sick, he's collapsed, and he sort of knows that his time is done. And I'll tell you what, I want to applaud the makeup on this film. That they do a really good job of making people look deathly ill. But the he basically says, I can't do here. I want to go home to Kansas City. Like, I want to go see my home in Kansas City, because he knows his wife and stuff was there. And so he joins a group of soldiers. He gets into the back with a bunch of soldiers, and they're driving off. And the end of the film, you know, this is going back to this idea of the American dream, this idea of building up a homestead and defending your home and all this other stuff. is he sort of like stumbles and staggers through the wreckage. You know, and again, they've kept it close quarters relatively, but it's like, it looks like a crater. There's a fireplace there and something. And he sees possessions that were once his. So there's a watch and a brooch and some of the bits and pieces. And he looks over and there's a family sort of under like a tarpaulin shelter. Clearly just as ill as he is.
Mm-hmm.
And he just looks at him and says, "Get out my house." And they look at him really confused, like, "What? What are you on about?" And but there's a genuine sort of like, you know, a sense of personal invasion. Like this was his space.
Well, this it was seems his to home. Me that it's about that powerlessness, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's like he's come there to die.
Yeah.
I mean, he knows he's dying. There's a great scene where, you know, he wakes up being, collapses being in charge of the hospital, and suddenly he's a patient and he wakes up and realizes, he says, "Oh, I'm dying." And so he's come there to die, and it's sort of like they're invading the sacred space to him.
Yes.
And it, you know, it's like, all, you know, as absurd as it is in this rubble, all I can do is protect my home, you know,
yes,
protect the wreckage of, you know, and of course it's stupid, right? I mean, it makes no sense. The home's gone. You're protecting a pile of rubble. And there's probably the corpses of your family buried underneath that rubble, right?
Yeah, I mean, the scene.
But he doesn't have the strength to do it.
No, I have to say, the scenes of him going through the rubble that they have done, there's some sort of superimposing of images on it, but they've done a really pretty effective view of a decimated city. And you say about this is a dark film, this is a hard hitting film. I mean, this film does not mess around with these images. But so it's showing you like a decimated city, you're showing the rubble, there's clearly bodies and stuff in that rubble. And you have this moment where he's like defending his home, as you said, that powerlessness. But it ends with him sort of falling to his knees, and this other person sort of just like lurches over to him, and it ends with them holding each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this again, this weird sort of, it's not a hope, like it's not a hug of, you know, we're going to get through this. It's an acknowledgement of how hopeless and powerless the situation is. And mm-hmm. and that kind of like, that's kind of where it ends. And as you say, I was looking for it, the dialogue here that it says at the end of the film. It says, "It is hoped that the images of this film will inspire the nations of this earth, their peoples and leaders, to find the means to avert the fateful day." And you're like, yeah, okay. I've spent two hours watching this, and I was, you know, kind of, I don't know. It leaves you not only kind of cold. It left me cold. Is probably the best way to describe it. Like, you know, it left me that sense of, we've taken, I think, some of this stuff for granted, you know. We had a period of the Cold War that culminated in the 80s, which I think felt more prescient because the USSR was sort of like on the, you know, clearly on the decline. But I think the media, the pop culture was picking up on it more than ever. But I think even now we sort of dismiss it. I feel a bit like there's that sense of being that student with the glasses that's like, well, why would we let that happen? It's a deterrent.
Mm-hmm.
It won't happen. But it just takes, you know, there are certain countries that are desperately trying to become nuclear powers, you know, Iran, North Korea, you know, Putin's got plenty of things, if, you know, just, and he's well, expansive powers. Who's to say that this isn't still a very real, you know,
it is.
Fateful
day. I mean, you know, Obama said what kept him up at night was India and Pakistan. You know, a nuclear exchange there. And, you know, all the research that I've done suggests that it really only takes, you know, like something like 1 to 3 nukes to trigger a nuclear winter that affects the entire planet.
Of the yield that we have now. Like, yeah.
Right. You know, we like to think that, you know, well, that's a survivable event, you know, for the planet if there's a nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan. That's not necessarily the case. Yeah, I mean, and I think that, you know, as somebody who grew up with this threat, you know, and is concerned about like the Fermi paradox and whether nuclear war is, you know, one of those thresholds, this is something I remain very worried about, you know, and I think that any scenario, you know, human brains are not good at predicting unlikely events. If you say there's like a 1% chance that, you know, something's going to happen, we say, well, I'm not going to worry about that. But, you know, there's a 1% chance that like a hurricane is going to wipe out your city, right? Maybe build the dams and, you know, because it's going to happen eventually, right?
Or if you, if you're Batman and there's a 1% chance that Superman is going to take her out, you know, you take out Superman and you get, you know.
Well, I mean, we don't need to go all Dick Cheney, you know, 1% chance of terrorism.
Yeah, I know.
Kill all
the
terrorists ahead of time. But, I mean, humans are very good at, are very bad at predicting and dealing with unlikely events and large scale consequences. We evolved in small scale tribal units. Our brains aren't good at thinking globally, but we're also really bad at predicting unlikely things.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you see this in like the markets where it's like, you know, yeah, it's unlikely that this company that's done well for 50 years is actually, you know, going to tank. But you think the odds of that are, you know, close to zero. In fact, the odds of that are probably closer to 1%. And, you know, that's going to happen. I think a 1% chance of the end of the planet, you know, is something that should be taken into account. I mean, the damage is so extreme, right? I mean, it's like you talk about mass shooters, you talk about, you know, all of these extreme events. The damage is so extreme that even though the percentage likelihood in any given year is small, there should be a very high priority, right? The damage of a meteor impact on the planet that destroys life. Yeah, it's very unlikely in any given year, but, you know, the consequences are catastrophic, right? You should be taking steps to prevent it.
That's right. We have oil riggers fully trained to go up into space at the drop of a hat. No, you're right. I think
we should,
I think one of the things that I think about, we've got our mid-season review in the next episode, and I'm going to save a couple of thoughts for that about how this film, but also just this whole post-apocalyptic kind of thing has changed my mindset. When you binge these kind of films in short succession, like, I think, you know, there's a it makes me think. But one of the things is I watched like the film,
we've damaged ourselves here
a little bit
for the listening audience,
and we still haven't got to Threads yet, so I've got to do the UK version of this on Patreon. I watched the Chernobyl HBO series you know, from a couple of years ago. I watched it relatively recently. And one of the things that sort of, you know, you mentioned earlier on was this idea of, should you be taken out in the blast or should you survive? And I'm very much in this sort of mentality. You sort of watch the things like, you know, you can see, we could sit here in the UK and say that Russia has dropped a nuclear weapon on the Ukraine, right? Or a part of Ukraine, or, you know, I don't know, wherever. And you go, well, that's hundreds of miles away. That's not a problem. You know, that's over 1,000 miles away or whatever. As you say, it's not, you know, those people that get killed in that blast are dead. They're done for. That's fine. But what happens with all that radiation is it's blasted into the skies, into the atmosphere. Like, which way are the weather channels going? Like, you know, what happens with the rate with the water that's in the atmosphere and all this other stuff? Like, the knock-on effects of that event can affect, as you say, everybody, and or the radius of impact of the fallout after is much, much larger. And that's where I start to worry. You go, okay, well, you know, it's not what, you know, happens today, tomorrow, or whatever, the day after. Okay, well, the increases of, you know, severe cancer increase in the next 12 months because it's all in the atmosphere, it's in the rain. Yeah, it, you know, we're all going to, it's the long-term or even the medium-term effects of something like that are actually catastrophic and painful and terrifying, and that's what kind of starts to worry me. So, you know, yeah, nightmares. That's where we're going with this. But it is, it's just a realization that, you know, and I do think as a species, you know, you say it's going to be the end of the world. It wouldn't. It'll be the end of us. Because the globe will just keep going. The world is indifferent to our presence for the most part.
Well, it's a decimation of the food chain.
Well, yes, you know? But I the
mean,
globe...
It's
the
not
but,
only
you know,
us, it's plant life and animal life. I mean, you know,
microscopic
life will probably survive. But I mean...
Well, that's it. But yeah, but it can evolve. It can regrow. And I think, you know, something may go on. But we wouldn't be here. But there's, I think about this with technology. And I'll end on this, really. But I thought about it recently that I think, you know, we've got AI and all sorts of stuff. And we say, like, oh, no, we can... You watch all these sci-fi films. And we've watched an awful lot of them where they're like, we're off into space. And we've got this incredible technology. And I think really the last sort of half decade has shown me, even the last decade really, has kind of highlighted to me that we've reached our technological, like there's a balance between technology and intelligence as a species. And we've kind of reached the sort of like technology to intelligence ratio where I'm like, yeah, you know, you've got enough toys now. You know, the idiocy quotation, it seems to be going up. And we've also got access to big red buttons that can do this kind of damage. I don't think we should, you know, I'm not saying I'm trying to be a Luddite. I don't want to stop things, but like, I don't know.
I'm not a Luddite. I mean, I love technology. I hate humans. Okay. You know, I mean, you know, and that's
bring
not
on
true.
Skynet.
That's true. I mean, you know, we talk about like people worry about the AI takeover and whether that AI will trigger a nuclear event. Right. And you know, that's a possibility, but it's also possible that it's what saves us.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what I worry about are chimpanzees' brains with nuclear buttons. Mm. Right. I mean, you know, and you talk about the global situation. All you need is some petty fucking dictator. Right. Who's like, yeah, I'm going out. Do I want? And I'm in a tumultuous political situation.
Vengeful mood. Yeah.
Yeah. Do I want to order a nuclear attack? Right? I mean, the world's survival should not depend on the whims of a chimpanzee.
Nope.
We are not set up to make rational decisions, you know, in the first place, but we're certainly not set up to make rational decisions about the survival of our species and all the other species. And so, yeah, the AI, you know, an alien takeover, I am on their side. You know, and what boggles my mind is the inability of humans to plan for those unlikely events, but also the inability of humans to set up adequate safeguards. Mm-hmm. Whether you're talking about the threat of, a dictator trying to use executive power in ways that it's not intended, and what are the safeguards? Set up the safeguards, set up the tripwires, you know, make sure that a nuclear response is unthinkable and requires, you know, as many safeguards as possible to prevent this kind of tragedy.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that we think systemically like that, right? I mean, even in the case of like, even in the case of, you know, tragedies of humans, right? We say, oh, this is terrible. This kid doesn't have any food. Well, let's set up a GoFundMe. You know, it's a happy story on the news. That's not a fucking happy story.
Yeah.
I'm glad that kid is going to survive. But you've done nothing to fix the system that
led to
starving, that. Right? Right? Like, that's not a happy story. In fact, you get to feel good about it. But, you know, it's like it's I'm glad Trump's not there anymore, but it's not a happy story. What happens when the next guy gets in and sees what he should have done on day one?
Yeah.
You know, the safeguards are not in place, brother. You know, so I worry about this. This is shit that keeps me up at night. It's like humanity's inability to plan long term and think rationally and set up appropriate safeguards for these catastrophic events.
And I think, yeah, I agree. I feel very much the same. And I think this is just, you know, this film. This film gets spoken about. I'd heard about it before we sort of brought it, you know, to do for this season, but I'd never watched it. And this was shown in schools. I found out that this was shown in some schools. And I think Threads, which we talk about on the Patreon, we will talk about on the Patreon, was a similar thing for British students. And I, you know, Googled it, and there were kids that were sort of older than me that were seeing it in 84. It was made in schools when it was sort of brought out. They were like, yeah, no, it gave me nightmares. But that was the thing. And it makes me wonder if, you know, I'm not saying we need to traumatise our kids, but maybe there is an element of going, I know this film's 40 years old, but it's a historical log of how people felt in the mid-80s, but also kind of worth thinking about, if you know, because I don't need to sort of take these things for granted anymore. I think we do take things for granted. I mean, that scene with the EMP,
mm-hmm.
The things it takes out, like the cars go out, radio goes out, motorbike goes out, TV, about it, right? Some hospital equipment, yeah? Play that out now.
Uh-huh.
Internet goes out, laptops go out, pacemakers go out,
mm-hmm.
Phones
fall
go
from
out,
the sky.
Planes fall from the
Got
sky.
Got a lot more of them today.
Cars, you know, just stop. All kinds of things just come to a grinding halt. Street lamps gone.
Your air conditioners. You know, a lot of people can't live without air conditioners.
Yeah. There's a lot of people on home care with medical units now. Gone.
And, you know, the thing is, a solar flare is going to do this, you know, at some point. We know this too.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, just like COVID, right? We know that's coming. Right, we're not our electrical grid's barely propped. It's propped up with gum.
Yeah,
you know, like we can't even maintain it, let alone prepare for this happens, and it's going
to
happen.
I think we have to be careful here, Julian, because I do think we're talking ourselves into becoming disaster preppers. And
we're going to be preppers any day now. That's the end of this podcast.
Yeah.
You know, like. Well, you know, we did the apocalypse season, and you know, we got a cabin somewhere.
We're now going to turn this into a preppers podcast as I build my nuclear shelter in the garden, fill it full of canned goods and purifiers.
It's going to be like G.I. Joe cartoon, you know, where like at the end, it's like knowing it's after battle. We've got prepper messages.
Yes. So yeah. You know, it's interesting. Anyway, we shall end on that delightful note. This is an interesting film. It's a fascinating film. And it's a very well done film.
A stunningly powerful film. And, you know, and I think it shows how you can make every mistake in the book, you know, in terms of, you know, performances and everything else. You know, there are lines that are a little clunky.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have no budget, but Meyer knows how to tug the heartstrings and how to structure something. And, you know, this is a masterclass in how to make a movie under those kinds of restrictions. And technically, there are a lot of ways this doesn't hold up. I'm sure there are some young people who would watch this and say it's hard to get through, you know, because of that. Because the special effects aren't, you know, like they're cozy little superhero movies, you know? But it is astounding how effective this movie is.
Yeah.
And I don't totally understand how and why, but it knows the emotional through line of every scene.
I do wonder if that I'm gonna finish on this now because I agree. I everything you've just said, 100%. I think this is effective, and it's just parts of me like I don't understand why it's effective when I watch it. Because there are, I could sit and I could have ripped this to pieces, as I've done with many other films where I'm like, the acting is bunkum, some of the dialogue is really sort of rote and clunky and da da da. But that's not the point of this film. And, you know, we've talked about things being like a mood piece. There's been other films that have been like a mood piece, like it gives you an atmosphere or a sense. This film kind of works in a similar way, but it's kind of like a doom piece where it's just like, here's the characters. They are you're used to them in almost like a soap opera kind of fashion, and then I'm going to decimate them. And it's just very, very effectively done. I also think, despite their special effects, as you said, you know, the you know, the missiles going up sometimes, or some of the sort of the stock footage or some of the other bits and pieces. It's balanced out by the impact of some of the makeup effects that I think are just simple but very, very effective. And also some of the leading performances, and especially in the second half, are just so impactful that it kind of makes up for it. So yeah, no, it's incredibly well done. And I think, you know, I'll be interested to see how it stacks up against, or threads, I should say, stacks up against this, because it's Threads done a year later and is you know, the UK version of this in many ways. But I can see why Ronald Reagan watched this and was like, oh, bugger. Like, you know, this is going to make him think about it. He wanted to stop this from going out at one point, that there was a notion of, like, you know, should the American people see this? And it was fought for, which is what sort of drove that the day before sort of campaign, to make sure it was broadcast. So anyway, I would say this is a fantastic film. Highly recommend it, just viewing it from that point of view. I do wonder sometimes if it's because you and I went through this to an extent, like we were kids. I was a bit younger than yourself, but like there was still that sense in the 80s of you know, this going on. We shall see. Watch it and find out. People, let us know what you think. Have you watched Threads? Have you watched it? How did this affect your childhood or when you watched it? What was the feedback, and did it keep you up at night? But we're not done there. Well, we are. This is kind of mid-season. The next episode is a mid-season review. We're going to stop, take a breath of radiated air, and take a look back at what we've done so far. The Full Mad Max Run, On the Beach, The Last Man on Earth, The Omega Man, Silent Running, A Boy and His Dog, and The Day After. And then following that is an interplanetary interlude of our apocalypse theory. We are going to be doing Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, and leading up to Alien Romulus. It's a bit of a special. We thought it's the right time to do it. Why not? We've both been discussing doing the Alien series at some point, and this feels like a good time to do it before we go on to do the rest of our apocalypse series. But don't forget, the apocalypse series will continue on the Patreon. And we are doing all kinds of things on there. We've done I Am Legend, the Quatermass conclusion, the Last Battle, the World, the Flesh, and the Devil, and of course Threads in the first half, and more will come after that. So go check that out. Link down below. £5 a month gets you all those different bits and pieces, as well as many other podcasts and content. So for those that do support us, thank you very much. But for those that don't, get your ass over to Patreon and show us some love. Anyway, Julian,
Absolutely.
thank you very much for
Thank you.
another great conversation.
We'll need that alien break, you know?
Yeah,
I want the sweet hopefulness of Xenomorphs.
yeah, that's it. I need the sort of yeah, I need that claustrophobia of alien, just so I can feel a bit sort of avoid the wasteland of the nuclear wasteland. But yes, anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your support, and hope you're enjoying this. As much as we are, clearly. But let us know what your thoughts are, and we shall see you on the next episode.